China has over a 200 times advantage over the United States in shipbuilding capacity. Is that accurate?
Yes. I think it's more like 230 times.
Okay.
According to CSIS. Okay. Yeah.
Somewhere around 230 times more. So if you're going to take action today that's going to impose docking fees on Chinese in order to stimulate American shipbuilding, it's going to be like probably a more than decade, maybe multi-decade process to even expand our capacity if we put a lot of focus and energy on it today. But that's not going to alleviate whatever's going on with this docking. How are those things actually connected in reality?
That's what I find so upsetting here is it doesn't seem to be a lot of thinking in realistic terms. And while it may sound good, like let's give an injection to the U.S. shipbuilding industry through these measures. And, you know, perhaps that is warranted in some respect. I mean, after all, it's not, quote, fair that all this trade goes on in with Chinese ships and no American ships. I'll grant you there's something there. But as you noted, the disparity is such that it's really at this point almost worth saying, let's say we can move the needle from 0%, which I think it is today, or less than 1% certainly on American hulls to 3% or 4%. Probably that's what it would probably take a decade to get to a number like 4 or 5%.
Man.
And then what? You know, what have we actually achieved? I mean, we may have put some Americans to work. We may have gotten the, you know, Philadelphia yard or some yards in Jersey or something working again. But the strategic benefit of that is very questionable, I would say. And moreover, you know, as somebody who focuses on the Navy and naval strategy, I would say that this is really not well thought out. I mean, to quickly, Danny, to make the point, our nation, we are not great at this point at building surface ships. It's just a fact that we've had kind of mistake after mistake, and we are missing, you know, whole groups of ships like frigates. But we are very good with what I consider the coin of the realm in naval power, and that is submarines. So we should focus on submarines, maintain our focus, and not get sidetracked on what I consider to be secondary or probably even tertiary. And moreover, because the way that naval strategy is going, just like every other domain of national security, is going toward drones. And so if we focus on drones and submarines, we'll be just fine in the Asia Pacific, and our naval power will remain very formidable.
So here's where we are, though, and where do we go from here? Because, I mean, what you're talking about, there's two separate. There's commercial shipping, and then there's military, the Navy kind of shipbuilding issues, and those have very different strategies, I would suppose. But what's in place right now affects commercial shipping, our own commercial shipping, for that matter. So here's where we are now. So we have an effective tariff rate of 157% on China. Trump acknowledged this morning that's not sustainable. We have export controls on rare earths, which we need. And we have now these really expensive docking fees, which are going to come back almost like in reverse tariffs, if you will. It's certainly going to have an effect on our consumers. I mean, it can't help anything to it. How do we get out of this? It's not going to spiral things into a worse economic situation for us.
Yeah, well, for one, I do want to say, I think one of the reasons that a lot seems to be going haywire here is I think there's a profound lack of China expertise at the top here. Probably, you know, I would say, looking at when this administration got started, the foremost China expert by far at the top of this administration was Elon Musk. And I think we're really suffering right now because there's no, I can't think of really anyone in the top ranks of the administration who knows China well. So, so this is a major problem because you don't have to spend much time in China to realize that they are a trade juggernaut par excellence with the shipping and shipbuilding to accompany that. And the idea that you're going to chip away at this. Anyway, the simple answer to your question, Danny, how do we get around this is for the president and his advisors to recognize that if they pull back on this port fees, like, you know, let's say the port fees were going to increase, you know, 1,000%. So walk that back to something like 100 or 200%, where, you know, you are throwing American shipbuilders a bone, fine. Honestly, the people who probably make money off it are the South Koreans and the Japanese. But in any case, we're trying to cooperate with Japan, with South Korea to get some shipbuilders, give them some relief and some help. But anyway, I'm just saying we can compromise a bit. Certainly we should compromise on the port fees because, as I said, there is no direct tie really to naval strategy as it's developing. And then the China, I think, would, I predict they would walk back this very draconian rare earths moves, because I think they probably even realize that they are really scaring a lot of businessmen with this talk, including their own. But in many other countries, I'll just give an example of where China may have dropped a big rock on its own foot here. In the last month or 2 months, China's relationship with South Korea has really been improving in a positive way. That's good for the United States, even, frankly, I would say. There are market improvements. For example, South Korea was pushing through kind of like visa-free travel with China. And these countries are very close. So, I mean, that really could radically transform the relationship. So this is all going very well. But now all of a sudden, this is the South Koreans are getting caught up in the U.S.-China trade war. And, this means a lot of turbulence ahead, a lot of headaches. So even for China trying to do business and improve its relations with South Korea, which I think is a major goal of Beijing.
Well, I want to shift gears here because bottom line is there's no easy answers for the administration, and I don't know if they're going to do that. And he still has this issue of this 157% tariff rate that, I mean, he can't just leave that there. He knows it's unsustainable. I don't know that anybody knows, probably even within the administration, but we'll leave that for the moment because that's something that's still going to be unfolded. Concurrent with all of that is the national security realm. Now, you have just published something at our parent defense priorities, Target Taiwan, Prospects for a Chinese Invasion. Actually, that's part of a larger series you just posted. Gary, if you could put that link up to the first one there, and we'll throw this in the description section for anybody who wants to find it, or they can just Google it, Defense Priorities, Target Taiwan. And there's four separate subcomponents of that, which maybe we'll have you back on to talk about the rest of them later. But I do want to look on that first one there about the challenges for Chinese invasion if they decided to invade Taiwan, because that's one of the biggest friction points, potentially even more than the economic stuff between the United States and China, going especially back into the Biden administration, where three or four times he said, yeah, we will fight China over Taiwan, even though he tried to walk it back. He kept on saying it, and this administration has been cooler on that, but not cold. And so it's still an open question whether we would or whether we wouldn't. One of the things I think you looked at here, and you can actually set this up here, that if anyone's considering that, we need to understand what the cost would be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, I think I would say that, Danny, the real purpose of all of these studies, and there are five of them actually altogether, one is yet to drop, but I see you've focused on the first one.
Yeah.
Great. But if I were to give a title that kind of like encapsulates the entire series, what are you trying to say, Goldstein? I am saying that the costs of this war, the risks of this war that we can envision are just stunningly bad for the United States and for China, but across the board, of course, for Taiwan, which probably would be destroyed even much worse than Ukraine has been destroyed. So, what we're looking at here is something so devastating. I call it the most dangerous spot in the world, although I don't like what's going on in U.S.-Russian relations either today. Yeah. But to me, this is, extraordinarily dangerous. The two superpowers, and I do call China a superpower in a way that I think Russia and maybe arguably the Soviet Union was never a superpower. Right, China has this incredible economic heft and economic strength, and national security strength are tied. So if China wants to build up a force of 5,000 or 10,000 nuclear weapons, they can do this in over the next decade, and they might. I think they're scratching their head and thinking it over. I do discuss in detail, not in this first of the series, but in the second of the series, I discuss the nuclear risks. That's yes, in that second paper, I have a long section detailing how, you know, there is a rapid nuclear buildup going on in China, and they're responding to what they consider, you know, a huge threat from the United States. But the first, there's the second of the series. The first paper, which you were looking at before, that one looks at what would happen if China attacked Taiwan and there was no American intervention. To summarize, I think it would be very bloody and very costly, but ultimately China would, I think, prevail reasonably quickly, probably within 2 months over the island. But the second paper then looks at what would happen if the U.S. intervened directly. And I know, you know, since we're Americans, we may focus on that second paper because we want to know, you know, well, how many Americans would die in this? And I'm telling you, my assessment is this is the cost would be enormous.
I actually want to ask a few specific questions about that, really, which would be in a case for either scenarios one or two, with or without U.S. Some of the points that you bring up here, which I don't think is really understood to a lot of depth for people outside of Taiwan or Chinese experts, and that is, you said geography matters, and geography on the land and on the sea, because these wars would take place on all three domains. And one of the interesting things you point out is that on the land, unlike, say, in the Russia-Ukraine war, which includes quite a lot of armored vehicles to include drones and everything else, but a lot of armor is involved here. But you said this one would be much more a infantry-centric fight. Why do you say that?
Yeah, well, and here my analysis departs from a lot of others. I think Stimson just had a study which focused a lot on the challenges that China would have in getting, you know, enough tanks onto the island. And they talk a lot about Taiwanese geography, but my interpretation of the battle space is very different. And if you look at the topography of Taiwan, you'll see that it has enormous mountains, and about 2/3 of the island are just these enormous mountains, which clearly are not, you know, that is not, I don't have to tell you, Danny, you're the former armored officer, so you know well, but tanks are not, you know, that is not amenable to tank warfare. So the actual area in Taiwan where tanks could be used is relatively small. It's kind of a strip about 100 miles long and 30 miles wide, you know, and that's being kind of generous. So And it's cut by these deep rivers that have all kinds of bridges, which probably would be dropped pretty quickly in a war by both sides, frankly. But the point is, and most of that area, that sort of western plain, if you will, which is not very large, it's mostly urban terrain. Taiwan's one of the most urbanized areas in the world. So, you know, the bottom line is, I don't think that armor is key to the campaign. I don't think China sees it that way. And that changes the whole approach to the landing, and that's where I think a lot of analysts
right.
have it wrong.
It's and then not that's where about, I wanted to go because you cover or at least pay attention to the Russia Ukraine war almost as much as I do, and I think that's really important. Why I was interested in having you on this topic here because you were looking at both sides, and because you speak and read both Chinese and Russian, you're able to look at what they say on each of these sides. And what I think we have seen from February 2022 up to the current time is that both the Russians and the Ukrainians have recognized that large armored formations are just no longer feasible because of the drone situation, whether that's bomber drones or certainly the FPV drones and the fiber optic drones, et cetera, these big Baba Yagas, et cetera. You still have to have them. They're important, but now then they're much, much less important because if you mass them, we've seen them everywhere, Russian or Ukrainian, they're going to die in large numbers. So it seems to me that perhaps, and this is more of a question than a statement, that the Chinese may be recognizing that and say, why even worry about going over there with a lot of armor that you can't really use anyway because drones are going to be an ever-present. So if you go in primarily on the ground with infantry and you can get them there in any number of ways, that's a lot less of a challenge than trying to get a bunch of armor over there, which may not do any good anyway. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are a lot of benefits to going with a infantry-centric focus. And I mean, the most obvious benefit is getting them ashore. I mean, it's a lot easier to pile a bunch of guys into a rubber boat and send them in where they can go into the shallows and they can go in these very high speed vessels. By the way, that's the doctrine I believe our amphibious forces have gone into. Smaller, they're more dispersed, where somebody who's sitting there with a javelin or something has to think, is it really, you know, is a little rubber boat with six guys worth this javelins? But and then there are 500 or 1,000 of these little rubber boats coming at you, yeah, which are in turn set in the water by, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 fishing boats. And I think a fishing boat is pretty well equipped to do that kind of thing. So, I mean, there are a lot of advantages just for getting them ashore. But then once they're ashore, look, if you're using basically light infantry, guess what? You don't need all that gasoline. And you know well, you know, I'm talking to an armored officer, but
I do indeed.
You know, what, how many gallons, you know, does a, you know, force of, you know, a brigade of tanks use or a company in you know, one day of intensive combat? I mean, it's immense amounts of
fuel.
Yeah,
it's enormous.
Yeah. And I mean, people often talk about D-Day in this context. And please remember, yes, we did bring tanks ashore. And yes, that, you know, American tanks were and British quite useful on the North German plain, you know, coming across France and into Germany. But that was a very different battle space than the one that, you know, that in the Taiwan circumstance, they're literally just pushing, you know, 20 miles inland. That's it. You know, it just doesn't have, Taiwan is completely lacking in strategic depth. So yes, I think China has been watching Ukraine continuously. And boy, you know, I watch Chinese military news pretty much on a daily basis. I could tell you they are working very hard on all aspects of infantry combat, in particular urban combat.
And what about the sustainability of it? Actually, you know, before that, let's get to the Taiwanese side of that equation, because many people have said that they have some version of a porcupine theory where they might make it so costly for China to come over that they would be deterred from doing so eventually. But then I've seen also other analysis that says, yeah, that may be in theory what they want to do, but the quality of the Taiwanese soldiers, they're not highly motivated. They have a hard time getting enough people even to show up for duty, et cetera, that many of them don't even think that there actually would be. And so the question is, how effective would the defending infantry force be in defending should China launch a concerted attack?
Yeah, there are a lot of questions here. Now look, if you study Taiwan's defense over a period of decades, you'll see for one, they haven't worried about it too much. You know, that comes for a variety of reasons, but if, you know, I think the 20-year average is something, you know, maybe slightly over 1% of GDP. So first of all, they're not spending very much. And what are they spending that money on? Frequently, they've spent it on, you know, importing fighter aircraft from the United States. I will tell you, I think many strategists have come to the conclusion that those fighter aircraft are going to be absolutely useless because those runways will all be destroyed. So now the Taiwanese Navy has also gotten, you know, considerable investment, and they have some frigates and even are now building a submarine, I guess, which has some problems, teething problems. But again, China, it's well within China's capability that both the Taiwan Air Force and the Taiwan Navy would just literally be destroyed for the Navy, it would be destroyed in port. You know, literally the ships would be sunk at the pier, most likely. Okay, well, what about the ground forces? As you imply, that's a pretty important group if you're facing an invasion. And indeed, there has been a kind of refocusing where I think many analysts are saying, well, boy, the Taiwanese would be wise to really stop pumping up their Navy and Air Force, which have real problems. Just getting into the fight and put it all in on the ground forces. So they've been neglected, like I said, for decades. They've always been the kind of poor cousin poor sibling, let's say, in the group of the Taiwan Armed Forces. They don't even fill the roles of their active force, which are under 100,000. So, I mean, if we compare the active forces, reserves are something different, and reserves are said to be neglected in Taiwan too. But if you compare the active force, you know, we're talking about over 1 million Chinese active ground forces against less than 100,000. So the odds, you know, when we're talking about professional soldiers, are pretty steep. Now, look, I'll give you that reserve forces can play a role here, but I think even in simulations, they're rated at, you know, even less than half the combat power of the professionals. And I think Taiwan's reserves are in deep trouble, from what I understand. Now, look, reforms are recommended, and I join that group of people saying, well, Taiwan probably should focus on its reserves. But I think they're in very, very deep trouble. And you can't, as you know very well, Danny, you can't just wish your way out of this and say, oh, we'll change, we'll change this regulation on reserve training and suddenly, Taiwan will be fine. No, it really, as colleagues and I have been saying for over a decade, is really what Taiwan needs is probably just to dig, because they are facing a whole lot of firepower coming at them. Which,
right. And by the way, just we've had Colonel Doug McGregor been on our show a number of times, and he's written a couple of different books specifically on the topic. And he says emphatically that if you wanted to transform your ground forces, you better have a full decade, because that's what it's going to take to turn it really into something good. And that's a decade of concerted year after year focus, effort, training, and some funding and logistic support and all that. And I haven't seen that so far.
He's exactly right. Of course, McGregor is fantastic, but it's also, again, I'll double underline the point that it's always the Air Force and Navy in Taiwan that have always gotten, the most money and the best, the best people and so forth. So it's, transforming that on it to its head with this porcupine strategy, let's say it's easier said than done.
Right. Yeah. There's no question about that. When you get in terms of who wins and who prevails in modern combat, really in any combat, I mean, you can go back centuries, really. One of the real driving factors, aside from training and organization, your forces, logistics, those things that are indispensable, they're crucially important. But there's another factor, and I think that is the motivation and the morale of the two sides here. And I think that there's a misapprehension in the Western view, certainly in the United States, that I wonder if you could talk to, in that, and you mentioned this in some of your pieces here, the focus and the importance that the Chinese face on reunification with Taiwan. I think you used a term, you said that it is a core issue for the Chinese, meaning that they're not going to be easily dissuaded. And if we send some more arms and ammunition and weapons and some additional capabilities, that's not going to make China go, all right, well, it'd be just too much, whatever. How important is it to the Chinese to have eventual reunification? And if it comes to fighting, will they just like say, we will go all in no matter what it takes, or can they be dissuaded by cost?
Well, I'm going to say very clearly here, and again, I'm a bit of a radical in the China field. I think there are many analysts who think, well, if we make the cost too great, then China will stand down, if you will. But I don't see any evidence of that. Quite the contrary. To me, all the evidence points the other way, and that this is a very, very deep obsession. That is in the DNA of the Communist Party of China, but also, within the leadership, that they consider this to be, probably the most important issue, certainly in the top one or two or three issues for how they consider, their whole identity. And this is why I often point out, because comparisons are made all the time with the Ukraine war, and some of these comparisons are appropriate, but most are not, frankly. I mean, just keep in mind that Taiwan is about almost 20 times smaller than Ukraine, which,
that's an important
says a lot right there.
It does.
Right.
And they don't have a whole bunch of friendly nations on their border that can just drive stuff in and out here. That's kind of important,
but,
too.
But getting back to your morale point, which I do think is essential. Look, you and I completely agree that is much more important than any weapons technology, or may even be more important than geography. Even that is the morale. What is the motivation of your fighting soldiers, airmen, and sailors? And to me, what I've seen is that when we say this is a core interest of China, what do we mean? I mean, this is literally integrated into all aspects of national life in China, but also of military life there. And so from day one of a soldier joining up in the PLA, he is told his central mission is to protect and unify the country. So this is every Chinese officer knows this, and soldier and so forth. Now, compare that to Ukraine. Even the Russian soldiers going in initially, they themselves were confused about what they were doing. And, you know, I myself worked some with the Russian military, the Russian Navy and so forth. And if any of them, you know, back in 2010 or something or 2005 could even imagine the idea of Russia and Ukraine going to war, it seemed like completely ridiculous. So put those two situations side by side. You know, in China, these people have been training for their entire lives and their entire mission set, their entire focus. Yeah, they do a few other things, you know, peacekeeping.
Great point.
They're almost 100% focused on this mission. Whereas in Russia, this was really shocking to the Russian military itself to be given this mission of getting, you know, heavily involved against Ukraine. And even to this day, you know, Russia, there are a lot of Russians who want no part of this. But I think that's just not at all the case in China. And you see that in the kind of focus and how China's developing all its strategies. I mean, the Chinese military, it all comes back to Taiwan ultimately. I mean, sure, they will engage in other things like the carrier program, for example. That's been a lot in the news. You don't need carriers to invade Taiwan. So, you know, you may scratch your head and say, what are they really doing with these? But ultimately, even the carrier program, everything is linked to Taiwan. And that kind of focus, that laser-like focus, I think will certainly carry the day. And that's why Americans would be very foolish to underestimate China's intent and even the morale of the PLA in a war.
Yeah, and let's pray to God we never find out that this stays in the academic realm and that we just can talk about it and never have to observe it. Listen, in the amount of time we have left, you mentioned the Russia-Ukraine war. I do want to go to that because that's in the news today. And yesterday, where President Trump announced, first of all, yesterday, that he had a phone call with Vladimir Putin, and he's setting up a high-level delegation this coming week between Sergey Lavrov and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and then that's hopefully going to set up some conversations and a meeting, possibly in Budapest, Hungary, between Putin and Trump himself to bring this to an end. But Trump said in his Truth Social and some other commentary that, you know, I think we have a good chance to get this solved. It's unclear what substantively changed from Alaska, but that's what he said yesterday. Well, also yesterday, we had the vice president who had seemed a different view. He says, no matter how energetic the diplomacy of the president of the United States could get people to the brink, ultimately it takes two sides willing to make a deal. And right now, for all our work, the Russians and Ukrainians are just not at the stage where they can make a deal. I think there's a fundamental mismatch of expectations where the Russians tend to think they're doing better on the battlefield than they actually are. So two parts there. First of all, what do you make of the seeming discontinuity between what President of the U.S. said and what the vice president said about the readiness to make a deal?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm trying to see all sides of this, you know, and I'm certainly listening to you and McGregor and Mearsheimer and experts like that, and trying to get battlefield reports. And you know, I'm fully convinced, partly because I'm a regular listening to your show, that that Russia has all the military cards here, or almost all of them. And so it's to me, you know, we are in a very delicate situation here where things could get much, much worse. Look, I do think the Ukrainians and, you know, the Europeans and the West, we're not entirely, you know, that is, there are some cards to play. I do think that my observation is that Russia wants more. They want a clean victory, and they're not that far from that. So that is kind of tantalizing, I'm sure, for President Putin. But on the other hand, they know that to reach that kind of state where they're in a kind of the clean victory, where they get everything they want, a full loaf, if you will, would still be incredibly costly and also quite risky, let's face it. So because a lot can go wrong between now and then. So even though things are going Russia's way now. So and I fully agree with you, your analysis, that the trends, clearly do favor that as we see them now.